You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Rick Santorum, he who is so terrified of gay people, is dropping out of the 2012 race so that he can run for president in 2016, assuming that Mitt Romney loses the election. Hey, it's worked for Republicans in the past. I mean, you know, it worked for Reagan. Actually, you could go back, I think, through quite a long history and find it working repeatedly. You know, it kind of worked, arguably, it worked for Nixon. So anyhow, Santorum is dropping out, has dropped out just an hour or so ago. Didn't mention Romney in his 20-minute dropout speech, although that will come. But he was talking to his base, and the reason that he didn't mention Romney is he didn't want to bind himself to a guy who's probably, in his mind, going to lose the election, and thus, in fact, I think he hopes that Romney will lose the election so that he can run in 2016. Because the way that the Republican Party works is that the guy who is running this year is the guy who came in second in the primaries 4 years ago. And you see this over and over and over again, whether it was Bush, not George W., but the elder Bush, whether it was Reagan, whether you just all the way back. Well, not all the way back, but it's sort of a tradition in the Republican Party. So here's the problem, though, with Santorum running for president in 2016. Santorum's primary platform, and he's probably going to reinvent himself over the course of the next 4 years, and he's probably going to reinvent himself in a less homophobic and probably, you know, more war hawkish religious. You know, we'll see what happens with Iran. There's rumors that Israel might attack Iran just before the U.S. election in November. How that will cut for the election, whether that's an October surprise that will help or hurt Obama, is a huge topic for debate. My guess is it would hurt, but who knows? In any case, my guess is that Santorum is going to reinvent himself because homophobia is, as an election issue, as something that you can win elections on in the United States, dropping like a stone. The younger generation, the people who are just reaching voting age, who are not yet 18 but are pushing toward it, are, along with their peers all the way up to, I'd say, age 30 or 40, pretty much tolerant of gays. I mean, it's in fact embracing their you know, the lines of friendship no longer are delineated by sexual preference. So this whole and you know, using gay as a slur and all this kind of stuff, I mean, it's just going away. And so Rick Santorum trying to be the homophobic nominee ain't going to work in 2016 because you're going to have, four more years and hundreds of thousands every year of people who turn 18 and of voting age and get the driver's license and register to vote. And unless they go off to college, in which case the Republicans will try to prevent them from voting. But you get the drift. So that's going on. Here's another thing that I find absolutely fascinating. This came from a great post, a great blog post by one of the guys over at VoteVets.org. You can read it there at VoteVets.org and also at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. If George Zimmerman had shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin on the battlefield in Iraq, he would be in front of a military tribunal right now. He'd be punished. Now think about this for a minute. If Trayvon Martin was an Afghan citizen or an Iraqi and was suspected of being a bad guy, and George Zimmerman had been a U.S. soldier and shot and killed him the way that he did, George Zimmerman right now would be in the brig and shortly would be standing before a military tribunal on charges. But on the streets of Florida, Zimmerman walks free. As I said, VoteVets.org points out today that Florida's Stand Your Ground, Shoot First law gives more leeway to shooters on the streets of America that our armed forces have to deal with hostile insurgents in Iraq. The rules of engagement are laid out, the ROI, or ROE, I guess they're called, and the rules of engagement, and all our soldiers have to follow these things. ROI is return on investment. All our soldiers have to follow these things. Here it is. When confronted with a threat, a soldier is required to first shout a verbal warning. Shout. Then show their weapon. Show. Then try to physically restrain the threat. For that, they say shove. Then fire a warning shot. Shot. These are four S's. And then if nothing else works, you can shoot the guy. Four steps you have to go through. If you don't go through those four steps, unless the other guy is actively shooting at you, if you don't go through those four steps, you're standing in the brig. You're standing before, and eventually you're standing before a military court. But according to Florida, and this is on the battlefield of Afghanistan, but according to Florida's Shoot First law, which is written by Walmart and the NRA with the help of the Koch brothers, American Legislative Exchange Council, all you have to do is say, I felt threatened. And you can jump right across that, hey, show the weapon, hey, shout, hey, try to restrain, push, you know, shove. You jump right over all that stuff and go right to shoot them in the chest. Or the head or whatever you want. More than 20 states have passed similar ALEC-written shoot-first laws since 2005, since Jeb Bush signed the first one into law in Florida in 2005. And this has led to a 25% increase in justifiable homicides across our nation. A 25% increase in so-called justifiable homicides. And by the way, the other thing that's going up along with us at the same time is the number of cops who are being killed. This is a general craziness. When the rules of engagement on the streets of America are more lenient than on the streets of Baghdad, then something is genuinely rotten in the United States. Florida and 20 other states where the stand your ground and shoot first laws are in place are turning America into a battleground. And it's a battleground where the rules of deadly force are even looser than in Iraq and Afghanistan. And once again, very specific things you have to do if you're a military soldier and you're on the battlefield, the things you have to do before you can kill somebody. It's called the shout, show, shove, shoot rule. You have to shout verbal warnings. You have to show your weapon and demonstrate your intent to use it. You have to physically restrain, block access to, or detain the person that you are concerned about. You have to fire a warning shot if you are authorized to do so, and then you may shoot to eliminate the threat. In states with the Koch brothers promoted stand your ground and shoot first laws in place, no need to shout, no need to show your weapon, no need to try to restrain somebody, no need to fire a warning shot. All you need to do is, to quote the law, feel afraid, and you can shoot somebody dead. Which means that Walmart, America's largest gun seller, can't be sued for selling the gun because the homicide is justifiable. And the Gun Sellers Trade Association, the NRA, they and all the companies that fund them make lots more money selling guns and ammo. Which may be why both work so hard on the ALEC task force that created the Stand Your Ground and Shoot First law. It's amazing. You ever wonder who's the most afraid of the other, black people or white people? I had a guy on the radio show the other day, African-American, who called in, and he said, you know, you guys, you can kill me as a white person. He says, you can kill me and not have to answer for it. And that fear is put on steroids by these shoot-first laws. This is the power of the lobby.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this power is turning America into a battleground filled with fearful, trigger-happy people. It's time to return to the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Now we should know how to communicate instead of coming to blows. We're on a roll, and there ain't no stopping us now. We're burning under control.
Sadly, whiplash indeed. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's really remarkable. Mitt Romney now is going to be the Republican nominee. You can count on that. So the 1%, in fact, the 0.1%, the 0.01%, which is Romney. I mean, he's worth $250 million. He makes $20 million and pays 13.9% income tax on it. This is the creme de la creme, right? This is the top of the top of the top of the 1%. And Mitt Romney is their guy. So the question that we all have to confront, and the question that it's going to be really interesting to see played out as we go into the election, is whether the 1% can buy an election, can convince enough people that it's in their, enough American voters, that it's in their interest to vote for the 1% or not. Now, as I've said before, I think that President Obama, by characterizing himself as a rich guy, makes a mistake. He says, people like me don't need a tax break. Well, Mr. President, respectfully, people like you 5 years ago were still paying off your student debts. Just because you made a couple million dollars because, you know, your books sold like crazy because you were running for and then became president of the United States doesn't really make you, I mean, I realize his income and net worth now is probably putting him in the top 1%. And I think as president, he makes over $300,000 a year, something like that, which is in the top 1%. But still, representing yourself as a rich guy, I wouldn't do that. Franklin Roosevelt was an incredibly rich guy. He was born wealthy. He was, you know, like George W. Bush. I mean, he was born with a trust fund. He was born so rich he never had to work a day in his life. But instead, he chose to become governor of New York and then president of the United States, among other things. But he never referred to that. He said instead he called out the economic royalists. You know, these economic royalists say that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they're really saying is that we seek to take away their power. And our allegiance to American democracy requires the overthrow of this kind of power. That's me doing Franklin Roosevelt. What, you got that up, Jacob? Oh, geez. Well, here's Franklin Roosevelt doing Franklin Roosevelt. Again, he's not referring to himself as the 1%.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power, and our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Yeah! People said, yay! Go for it! And you know, so Roosevelt never took that position of, hey, I'm a rich guy just like these other rich guys and I don't need a tax break. He said, these rich guys are trying to screw America. They're trying to overthrow this country. They're a threat. They wrap themselves in the flag and the Constitution. But in their blindness, they don't know what the flag and the Constitution stand for. In reality, they stand against rule by mob rule, and they also stand against rule by an elite. Roosevelt had that to say as well. I don't know if you found that one, Jacob. No, you didn't. Okay, that's fine. So Roosevelt just laid this out. But anyhow, with the 1%, here's Romney. He paid 13.9% taxes on $21 million in income. He paid a lower tax rate than a Wisconsin teacher. Tell me that's right. Why is this? Oh, yeah, George W. Bush. He explained all about it. Clip 15, Jacob. Here's George W. Bush just the other day. I believe it was just yesterday.
If you raise taxes on the so-called rich, you're really raising taxes on the job creators. And if the goal is private sector growth, you got to recognize that the best way to create that growth is to leave capital in the treasuries of the job creators.
Right.
Secondly, if you raise taxes, in other words, if you let the, I wish they weren't called the Bush tax cuts.
If they're
called some
like
other
Bush.
Body's tax cuts, they're probably less likely to be raised.
Because people hate Bush.
But if you raise taxes, you're taking money out of the pockets of consumers. And it's important for policymakers to recognize that all the doubt about taxes causes capital to stay on the sidelines.
Yeah, all that doubt. We're all so concerned. I'll tell you, as a guy who has been running businesses and started a number of them, been running businesses my entire life, my entire adult life, I mean, literally since I was 17 years old, the thing that causes business people, entrepreneurs, even large businesses, having worked with many very large businesses, having been a consultant to many of the Fortune 500 companies and worked inside their companies, the thing that moves a business is not uncertainty or certainty in the marketplace. It's got nothing to do with it. It's demand for your products. If there's people out there who want to buy something, you're going to figure out, if you're a business person, you're going to figure out a way to make it and get it to them. Where does that demand come from? It comes from money in people's pockets. Not people like Mitt Romney. He takes that money and puts it in that Swiss bank account he's got. It's people like the teacher in Wisconsin who pays a higher tax rate than Mitt Romney, who spends nearly 100%, the vast majority, but probably, typical Americans save 1, 2, 3% these days. So well over 90, 95% of their income, they spend. That creates demand. Demand is what drives economies. So it's really simple. You know, the job creators are the consumers. And if you want to see jobs created, give the consumers better pay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's got nothing to do with the tax rate, by the way, at the bottom. I'll explain after the break how those tax rates are different, and we'll pick up your calls. Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Dean, listening on AM 760 in Island Ranch, Colorado. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just first want to say I was born and raised in a very conservative Christian home. And I want to say you single-handedly and David Sirota here in Denver have changed my political worldview. And I just want to thank you for that.
You're welcome.
One thing I wanted to
although,
say was,
although I have nothing against Christian homes or conservatives for that matter. My mother was a perfect Christian and my dad was a hardcore conservative. Well, not hardcore. He was an Eisenhower conservative, but you get the drift.
Well, I too am a Christian, but you know, not the Rush Limbaugh, you know, Bible bashing conservative.
Yeah, I call myself a Christian. I don't call myself a hater. Anyhow, what's your question, Dean?
So what I wanted to ask you was, you know, one of the big talking points from conservatives is they focus on the budget, the deficit, you know, balancing the budget, and they want to do it through spending cuts.
Right.
I, too, am concerned about the budget, the deficit. I don't want to turn out like Greece.
Greece is Greece because they don't control their own currency. They cut a deal with Goldman Sachs to hide the fact that their debt ratio was over 3%, which would have disqualified them for membership in the European community and to use the euro and give up the drachma. And they wanted to do that because they thought that there was some economic benefit to it. So they cut a deal with the devil, first of all, which put them badly in debt to Goldman Sachs. And then they joined the EU and they gave up their own currency. Normally when a country, you know, if a country gets itself in trouble, it can get to a certain extent out of trouble by upwardly or downwardly valuing its currency. That'll change its trade balance relationship with other countries, because if your goods become less or more expensive, people import more or less of them. And it also changes the cost of repaying debts. If you deflate your currency, or if you decrease the value, inflate your currency, decrease the value of it, you can pay off older, more expensive debts with, you know, cheaper drachmas. Greece can't do any of those things. Greece doesn't have a central bank that can adjust its interest rate so that businesses will be there and will choose its currency over other currencies. It has none of those capabilities. The United States has all of those capabilities. We will never be like Greece.
Okay, well, I guess my only next question is then, with regard to increasing taxes on the wealthy, another thing I've been told by conservatives is that it can't and won't solve the problem. And I personally don't want to increase taxes unless it's going to help solve the problem.
Well, what's the problem that you want to solve?
Balancing the budget.
Why is that a problem? We haven't had a balanced budget since the George Washington administration.
Okay. How about going toward a path in which our debt doesn't continue to increase?
Okay. Well, Bill Clinton did that. He raised the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires from 36% to 39%. And within 3 years, he had a balanced budget, and they were projected to pay off the entire national debt within the next 15 years had George Bush not come in and dropped taxes and declared two wars that were not paid for.
Okay, so... So
your conservative friends who are telling you that raising taxes won't do it, if they have any confidence whatsoever in history, you know, if they're capable of just looking backwards a decade or two, all they have to do is look at the last 3 years of the Clinton administration, when you had, you know, Clinton left office with a balanced budget and a surplus. I don't know if you remember the 2000 election, but one of the biggest debates of the 2000 election was, what are we going to do with the peace dividend? What are we going to do with this surplus? You know, the Soviet Union has fallen. We don't need all these nukes. We don't need a overamped military. And beyond that, the tax increase that Bill Clinton put into place has got us to the point where we've got a budget surplus.
Well, but I mean, you know, they would say, well, that was the dot-com bubble. And so we had a lot of economic growth, and it just, you know, things would have been better had the lower tax.
And there's some truth. Well, actually, the first half of that, there's truth to that. Things to a large extent, the reason why you had a budget surplus was because the economy was rip-roaring, you know, white hot. And it was white hot because it was in a bubble, and it was in a bubble because the tax rate was below 50%. Whenever the tax rate on people making over $1 million goes below 50%, we've seen this twice in the 20th century, and we've seen it many times in other countries. Whenever it goes below 50%, what you see is bubbles start forming, because people, very, very wealthy people, have a bunch of hot money that wasn't dear. It wasn't hard to get. It was very easy to get for them, and so they don't value it a lot, and so they're willing to take bigger risks with it. And so they invest in riskier things, looking for higher returns, and that's the definition of what drives a bubble economy. But the point that I would make is that when you said the economy was really rolling along, and or words to that effect, and that, you know, increased tax collections, that's absolutely true, and that's how Eisenhower got us out of a worse debt deficit that we have right now. After World War II, the debt was our debt to GDP ratio, which is right now about 85-90%. It's coming up on 90%. It's in the high 80s right now. In other words, the total amount of money that we owe is equal to the total GDP of the country, which, again, is, as I said, this is not a problem for a country that controls its own currency. Japan's debt to GDP ratio right now is 220%. Ours is about 80%. But after World War II, it was 127%. So what did Dwight Eisenhower do to pay that debt off? Because he did. He paid it off in 8 years. Virtually all of it. What did he do? He borrowed. Actually, the president before him had increased the top marginal tax rate to 91%. Eisenhower kept it there, and he borrowed money. He borrowed more money and used that to build a national highway system, hospitals and schools all across the country, and upgrade our rail capacity so that American industry would have an infrastructure and an educated workforce. Eisenhower sent mostly men, but people coming back from World War II on the GI Bill. He continued that and expanded it, sent them to college, not just for free. When my dad went to school on the GI Bill, he got a $100 a month stipend for going to college. They not only paid his tuition, they paid him for his food and you know, for part of his lodging. So that's what Eisenhower did. This is what President Obama was proposing. We've got a $2 trillion deficit in our infrastructure. We haven't, since the Reagan administration, we have not been repairing the infrastructure that goes back to the Civil War. I mean, you've got places, Bernie Sanders told the story in Vermont about, you know, he was at a city where they were repairing the water system, and the mayor had a piece of the water system that they dug up earlier in the day. And he said, you know, one of the guys who put this into the ground was a war veteran. And Bernie said, what war? And the mayor said, the Civil War. I mean, that's how old the infrastructure is that needs to be repaired. $2 trillion deficit. If we put that kind of money, or even a fraction of that, into simply rebuilding our 19th and 20th century infrastructure, it would solve our unemployment problem. Just like, you know, Dwight Eisenhower did by building highways and building schools and building hospitals. It would solve it. And then that would then put money in people's pockets, and those people would buy things, which would create demand for manufacturing, and you see factories come back.
So, Tom, then I guess my last final question is, what would you say to, you know, I know the Congressional Budget Office came out with a report that says our economy is going to, quote-unquote, collapse at current spending after 20 years or something. Where do they get... Where do they get saying that our economy is going to collapse if you're saying that, you know,
they don't.
Having
the CBO never said our economy is going to collapse.
Okay.
It's not the kind of language that the CBO would use. It's just not. I mean, you know, what they would say is that the debt to GDP ratio will exceed 225% in the year 2073 years. I mean, they would just lay out the numbers. They don't draw conclusions, and they don't use words that are descriptive like that. That's not something the CBO does.
So in the end, you would say that us having a certain amount of debt or a certain amount of deficit doesn't mean that we're going to eventually become like Greece. I think
no, not at all. This is something
in their head.
No, of course they all have it in their head. And you know, this, you can track this back to June Wodinski. Back in the 1970s, this Republican strategist came up with this theory. He called it the two Santa Claus theory, published it in the Wall Street Journal, and it was adopted by the Reagan administration. And it has been adopted by Republicans ever since. And he said, for the last 100 years, the problem that Republicans have had and the reason why they have a hard time getting elected is because every single Santa Claus event that the government has ever done has been done by Democrats. It was Democrats who said 40-hour work week. It was Democrats who said a 5-day work week. It was Democrats who brought Social Security. It was Democrats who had Medicare. It was Democrats who had Medicaid. It was Democrats who had, you know, workplace safety rules. It was Democrats who made safe cars. It was Democrats who brought, you know, safe food and drugs and all these things. These were all Democratic Santa Claus things, and the Republicans opposed all of them. So the Republicans were always Scrooge. So he said Republicans have to figure out a way, A, to become Santa Claus, and B, to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus, their own Santa Claus, the Democratic Santa Claus. And the way they do that is, Jude Winiski said in 1974, is when you've got a Republican president, borrow as much money as you can, as fast as you can, spend it like crazy. It'll stimulate the economy and make it look like you've got a great economy, and it'll leave a huge debt to the Democrat who's next elected. When that Democrat's elected, you start screaming about the debt, and force that Democrat to stop spending, in other words, to shoot Santa Claus, to cut back on Medicare, to cut back on Social Security, to cut back on programs for the people. And that's why when Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt, Ronald Reagan in 8 years borrowed more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. When he did that, there wasn't a peep out of the Republicans. When George Herbert Walker Bush added another almost $2 trillion to that debt, not a peep out of the Republicans. The day after Bill Clinton was sworn in, the Republicans were hysterical about the debt. It was going to destroy us. Thanks,
Steve. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You get it? There's a strategy to this. And then George W. Bush comes in and he borrows another $5 trillion. Not a word from the Republicans. As soon as Obama's in,
it'll come true.
Welcome back, Tom Harmon, here with you. Tom in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, the right keeps saying that if you raise the taxes on the 1%, that it's going to cost jobs and corporations. You have to lay people off and stuff.
Yeah, that's what George Bush said. Here's a really simple question. Three times in the 20th century, we saw significant tax increases on the very rich. Once in the 19-teens, once in the 1930s. And in both cases, those tax increases were followed by growths in the job market.
Well, what I understand, I might be wrong, but isn't that a tax on the individual, not a corporation?
Yes.
Yeah. So the money is already taken out of the corporation before it's taxed.
Yes.
Yeah. So how could that cause any job loss if it's money that's already...
It won't. When George W. Bush calls CEOs job creators, he's using a Frank Luntzism. This is the big lie. It's Tom. I'm sorry, your phone is echoing back at me. But I think you made your point. Thank you for the call. The big lie is that these people are sitting around going, "Gee, I got some extra money. I think I'll create a job." People don't create jobs. People hire people to do work for them. And in the United States, we've actually gotten more efficient. It's an op-ed in today's New York Times pointing out that, you know, a decade ago, the average worker was producing over $380,000 for their employer. Now, the average worker in America is making $26,000 a year, so you can do the math on that, making over $380,000 for their employer. Now they're making over $400,000 for their employer. Employers don't sit around and say, gee, I think I'll hire somebody because I'd love to give somebody $26,000 a year or $50,000 a year or whatever. Employers hire people because they say, you know, okay, I figured out a way that if this person works for me, he or she can generate $300,000 or $400,000 for me, for my business, for this company. It's really, really simple. John in Washington, D.C., you wanted to talk about the Trayvon Martin case.
Yes, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. I just wanted to say, just from a law enforcement perspective, the law in Florida with the Trayvon Martin case allows its citizens more leeway to use force than an enforcement agency. The law enforcement agencies in Florida, in order for them to use lethal or deadly force, they have to prove, number one, that their life was in imminent danger, and that's the wording that is used, imminent danger, and that to prevent themselves from getting seriously injured or their life taken or someone else's life, that's when they can use deadly force as well. If that person, third party's person's life was in imminent danger from serious injury and or death.
Are you a law enforcement officer?
Yes.
So you're familiar with these laws. So what you're saying, I went through this rant about how on the battlefield of Afghanistan, our soldiers, unless they're being shot at, if they have a suspicious character, they have to show their weapon. They have to shout at that person, get their attention. They have to show their weapon and indicate that they're willing to use it. They have to then try to physically restrain the person. And if all those fail, then they can shoot them, right? And so they're more restrained than George Zimmerman was. You're saying now that police officers in Florida have more restraints on them than George Zimmerman did?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm just surprised no one ever brought that up. That's amazing to me. And also, you know, when you speak about the military, they have more restraints on them than anyone. It seems to me they would have less restraints. If I'm in Afghanistan and something comes down, I mean, people shoot you just for the sake of shooting you because you got that red, white, and blue on. It seems to me that you have more reason to protect yourself. Just being over there, my life is in imminent danger, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. John, thank you for sharing that with us, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. I appreciate it. Mike in Atlanta. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Not last Saturday, but the Saturday before, I was sitting down watching Cops, and the first segment that came up on Cops was out of Tampa, Florida. There was a woman called saying that she was being harassed by three guys. The police showed up. Apparently, she was walking her dog. The guy had made a sexual comment to her. She walked over and said, I don't appreciate the way you are talking to me. They followed her. The guy that was talking to her pulled a knife. He followed her. Another guy went and got a piece of pipe, and she called her boyfriend on the phone. He came and got her, and they went back to her house. Right. They called the police. When the police showed up at these other guys' houses, the first words out of their mouth were, I'm standing my ground. I'm standing my ground. And the cops said, no, you weren't. You were menacing. When you leave your property, you are no longer standing your ground.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is getting to the point now where, you know, I think that's exactly what Alec wants. They want people shooting at each other. They want the Wild West.
Well, this is what has produced since Jeb Bush signed this law in 2005, the very first of the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws in Florida, the first nationwide. We now have 21 states with them. These laws that are written by the NRA and Walmart and promoted by the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Koch brothers. Since that happened, since 2005, justifiable homicides, murders are homicides that are labeled as justifiable because of Stand Your Ground laws, have increased in the United States 25%. And the killing of police officers is on the rise, too. I think you're right. I think that there's a Wild West mentality that's happening, and it's not a good thing in this country. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. JP in Detroit. Hey, JP, what's up?
Hey, Tom, pose the fallacy of your worldview if you hear me out. Number one, the money being spent by lobbyists in Washington is not the cause of the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. The symptom is, or the cause is, that government controls trillions of dollars in tax and regulatory policy that invites and encourages this lobbying. So if you take away the government's ability to pick winners and losers, then where are these people going to go to get favors?
Right. So let's just say that the government can no longer say to the Koch brothers, sorry, you can't throw all that mercury in the air from your refinery. You can do anything you want.
No, as long as there's externalities, they're dealt with through the judicial system.
So if your child is born with autism and you think that it was caused by mercury from a coal-fired power plant down the road, you should just sue them? Is that what you're saying?
You take them to court.
Yeah, right. And let's say you make $25,000 a year, like the average, $26,000, like the average American. How are you going to hire a lawyer?
If they were found in a court of law.
No, how are you going to hire a lawyer to get into that court of law?
Then you put them in jail.
How are you going to hire a lawyer to get into that court of law? How is the average American going to hire a lawyer to sue a multimillion dollar corporation? This is the problem with libertarian theology. And it's a theology. It's a religion. It's never been demonstrated to work.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Maggie Gallagher, the co-founder and immediate past president of the board of the National Organization for Marriage, nationformarriage.org is the website, is on the line for us. This is basically an anti-gay marriage group, Maggie, or a pro-straight marriage group. I'm not sure how you describe yourself.
I like to use the term pro-marriage, but pro-traditional marriage is, I guess, something people also say.
Well, you don't mean traditional marriage, because that would be polygamy, right? I mean,
no, actually, it's never been traditional in this country. I'm an American. My tradition, my sense of the traditional ends with,
So your idea of how we should define our laws goes back 200 years.
Something like that.
But if you were African-American 200 years ago, you couldn't marry at all. Because your master
You could if you were in a free state, but not if you were enslaved. And boy, was that an evil system.
Yeah. Rather than going down that road,
I'm not pro polygamy, though.
Yeah, and you're not pro slavery, I'm assuming. North Carolina's Amendment 1 would establish marriage between a man and a woman as the only legally recognized union in the state. There is a lot of concern that what this will do is say that the domestic violence laws, which recognize a relationship, a partnership, but don't require legal marriage, that those laws will become unenforceable.
I think that's fear-mongering, frankly. I know that other people may disagree, but they said that in Virginia before the Virginia Marriage Amendment. They said that in Wisconsin before the Wisconsin Marriage Amendment. None of those tactics have come true. I mean, nothing horrible happens when you define marriage in your constitution as one man and one woman, unless you think not having gay marriage is horrible. So
right.
I think that's the real issue here.
Well, and the other thing that concerns me is I don't see, Louise and I have been married for, almost 40 years. I don't see how somebody who is gay getting married is going to change my marriage at all, or for that matter, anybody's around me. And I don't understand why anybody would be obsessed with this issue. And now we have these four separate studies coming out of Germany and one out of the University of Essex and two in the United States that show that on average, the people who are the most homophobic, who are the most aggressive about trying to deny gays their rights, are themselves repressed gays. I'm curious, are you attracted to people of the same sex?
I'm very attracted to people of the same sex, but just not sexually. I saw that study. I think it's amusing. It of course had nothing to do with the marriage issue. And it was
Why not?
A study of men so I don't really think it's relevant to me.
Okay.
But in any case, people, one of the things I really hate, Tom, frankly, and I usually refuse to do this, is I hate to psychologize other people's arguments. I know a lot of liberal and progressives,
but you're psychologizing the issue of marriage.
How somebody could care about that it's important that marriage is the union of husband and wife, because it's the one social institution that represents the ideal that children need mothers and fathers. And so they have to figure that there's some secret, dark, other reason for it. But really, that is my reason.
And yet, when you look at the science on this, Maggie, what children really need is loving parents. And sometimes even just loving parent. That a child with, you know, being raised by a single parent is better off than a child who's raised in foster care or a child who's raised in an institution. And that a child raised in a gay family is just as well adjusted and, you know, just as likely or unlikely to grow up to be gay as a child raised in a straight family.
I actually don't think we know that scientifically. The one thing we do know from, and again, I think children can be raised well in all family forms. I'm not surprised to learn that there are gay parents that are good parents. I'm not proposing to take away anyone's child.
Well, in fact, generally, they're better parents, Maggie.
But the idea that there's something special about bringing together the man and the woman who makes the baby so that they love each other and the baby, too, that is the heart of the marriage idea. I think of the studies, you know, and I actually have looked at, I've actually read 50 studies on gay parenting. There is not a single one of them that looks at children raised from birth by same-sex couples based on what scientists call probability samples, nationally representative data, and follows them through adulthood and compares them to other family forms.
Well, they've only been doing these studies for about 15 years. I mean, you haven't had out gay couples adopting kids for more than 15 or 20 years. But the studies that have been done show, you know, you just put a lot of caveats around that. Let me make this point, though, if I may, Maggie. We've been interrupting each other, and it's fine. Gay couples who want to have children have to work at it. Straight couples who want to have children do so accidentally more often than not. And so you've got a lot of kids in straight families who really weren't wanted, whereas in gay families you've got kids who were almost always wanted. Doesn't it make sense that when a couple has to work to have a child or to adopt a child, that couple is going to work harder at being parents and be better parents? Shouldn't we be encouraging gay marriage so that gays can raise kids in a way that is really committed, as opposed to straight couples who just, you know, have sex and boom, oh, you're pregnant. Oh, sorry about that.
I have to respond to two things because they go in different directions. The first is, this is absolutely no evidence that gay marriage is going to have any effect on children in gay families at all.
Effect.
No, it doesn't really.
It does.
We'll get into that.
If one of the parents or both the parents die, what happens to the kid? If the child comes down with cancer, who's going to make medical decisions? I mean, there's thousands of legal decisions.
What I would say on that is that a gay parent who relies on gay marriage to protect their children is making a mistake. You really need to go to adoption because it'll be recognized in all 50
states. I'm assuming adoption
nationally.
I'm assuming adoption, but if there are over 10,000 laws at the state and federal level that use the word marriage, where you
and
don't.
None of them relate to parental relationships.
Many of them relate to parental.
Adoption is the way. But the other thing I want to say is that being wanted or one.
No, wait a minute, Maggie, before you move on. If one parent is the biological parent or the adoptive parent and the other parent isn't, and it's a gay couple and they're not married, that second partner is not going to have rights relative to that child, and they should.
Parent adoption, they should not depend on marriage. If there are any gay people listening, you need to know the only way to protect your parental rights is to go through the process. The adoption process, which is how we transfer rights from biological parents.
But two people who are not married cannot both adopt the same child.
Well, actually you can in a number of states. And if that's not true in Minnesota, that would be, or wherever we are. Sorry, Tom.
North Carolina is it. But why not just, you know, you've got people who are born gay. Why not just let them get married like everybody else?
Well, because they don't want to get married. They don't want to marry. I mean, gay men don't want to marry.
But then why are they pushing for it?
Because it's not marriage. You're missing my point. The idea.
It's not religious. It's not marriage according to some churches.
No, it's not marriage according to the great cross-cultural human understanding of what marriage is and what it's for, which is deeply rooted in the reality. Just what you pointed out. You know, we need a social institution called marriage that's directed to bringing together men and women to protect their children.
Yes.
This has really nothing to do with gay relations.
And it doesn't have to be men and women. It could be men and men, or it could be women and women. But they need to have the legal protections to protect their children and each other.
Can I go back to the thing that you didn't let me finish because I keep saying things
sure, we have a minute.
Provocative?
We have a minute.
Yeah, I just want to say it doesn't for the us heterosexuals in your audience or suppressed homosexuals. It doesn't matter whether a child is wanted. If you're married and you love each other and you have a child, 99% of those children will be protected.
Right, but
there's
a bunch of if-thens in that, Maggie. And you know, I get your
marriage argument to make. There's a lot of if-thens in life.
No, I get your point, but marriage doesn't in and of itself guarantee good parenting. In any case, Maggie Gallagher, nationformarriage.org is the website. Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. We'll see. The very interesting statistic about people in North Carolina who say they're going to vote for this, I'll share it with you right after this break.
Yes, I'm sorry to be the one that has to say if you're homophobic, you're probably gay.
Back to Talk Media for the sane among us. The four separate experiments consisting of this written by John M. Becker, published last week. I have the link, but I don't have what the link points to. I'm sorry, I can't identify the publication. Four separate experiments consisting of an average of 160 college students each were conducted in the U.S. and Germany. And bottom line, people who sit around and think about gays all the time and describe themselves as hating gays, as homophobic, or not liking gays, or being afraid of gays, are gay. And they're fighting it. Netta Weinstein, who was a lecturer at the University of Essex, this is a separate study that was done in the UK, says, quote, individuals who identify as straight, but in psychological tests show a strong attraction to the same sex, may be threatened by gays and lesbians because homosexuals remind them of similar tendencies within themselves. And speaking of Rick Santorum, he has said, he just came out an hour or so ago and said that he is not going to be continuing his presidential campaign. He's putting it on hold. The implicit reason is that his youngest daughter got sick and it's just too much and all this kind of stuff. I would say the explicit reason is that he has made his point. He's the last man standing before Mitt Romney. He's the number two guy, and therefore in 2016, he'll be the presumptive number one guy. And to Rick Santorum, I say good luck with that, because Jeb Bush is going to be all over you. And Marco Rubio is going to be all over you, and et cetera, et cetera. And homophobia is not going to play as well in 2016 as it did in, you know what, back 6 years ago, I guess it was, the Santorum, 4 years ago, whenever it was, the Santorum overwhelmingly lost his U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania. I find this just absolutely fascinating. There was another study. This corroborates a study that was done back in 1996 by Dr. Henry Adams at the University of Georgia, where they wired up men, their apparatus, to a machine that measures expansion, and showed them straight porn and gay porn. And the people who were not homophobic, this was all people who said that they were straight, right? People who are like, you know, I don't sit around, I have gay friends. I don't sit around thinking about what they're doing. What are they like? What, you know, what are they up to? Or people who are not, you know, who I don't know who are gay. It's like, it doesn't occur to me to think about it. It's like live and let live. And I think that's true of most people. But there are people like Rick Santorum who sit around all day long and go, there's gay people who want to get married. We got to do something about this. Oh, look at, I wonder if that couple there is gay. Look at, there's two men walking down the street. Keep watching. They might touch their hands to each other. You know, I mean, there's actually people who just kind of obsess on this stuff. Who, if you ask them, they'd say, oh, I'm totally straight. Larry Craig. Rick Santorum. I mean, these guys, every hair is in play. Well, no, that's now I'm catering to stereotypes. But The point is that why would somebody obsess on people who are gay unless they themselves are gay? Well, this is what the research finds, that when they showed these men who identified themselves as being straight, he says, I'm totally straight. Okay, great. You're in the study. Now we're gonna wire your wanker and we're going to check some stuff out here. And they showed them straight porn and they all got interested, shall we say. Then they showed gay porn. And the people whose opinion is sort of like mine, like, you know, so what? Somebody's gay, right? The people who had that attitude, or God bless them, or live and let live, the people who had that attitude, they were not aroused by the gay porn. But the people who were openly homophobic, the people who said, oh, I don't, what, sitting next to a person who's gay people getting married? Gay people in my shower? Those people, when they were shown gay porn, yes, they got the proverbial bulge. So now we have six good, solid studies done since 1996, all of them showing that homophobes, people who obsess on gays, are probably gay. More, you know, this is not a reflection on my last guest, because not all of them are, but most of them are. So, you know, now I think this is one of the reasons why homophobia doesn't sell the way it used to. Because in the 1950s and the 1960s, or still in some communities, in the African-American community to some extent, in the Mormon community, in some of the other fundamentalist religious communities, in the Anabaptists, if you raise your hand and say, hey, I'm gay, you're out. You're socially ostracized. So people who are wired to be gay, who are born gay in those communities, are afraid to raise their hand and become discriminated against, become trashed, become beaten up, become shot, become murdered. I mean, you fill in the blank, right? They're afraid to do that. The Larry Craigs of the world, they will say, oh, well, I'm actually straight, and I'm going to get married and have some kids. The Marcus Bachmans of the world, in my humble opinion. And so they live this straight life and even produce offspring. But all the time they're obsessing on those gay people. Why are they thinking of those gay people all the time? Because they're gay themselves. Come on, this is common sense. And it's good science now. So my point is that young people now who know that they're gay don't try to hide it. They don't try to have these so-called straight lives. They just come out as gay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And therefore, the number of homophobes, gay people pretending to be straight, in our population is decreasing over time. Good thing. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Jennifer in Santa Cruz, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Jennifer, what's up?
Oh, thank you so much. I wanted to make an important point about the legal importance of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I was with the same man for 26 years. We had 3 children, and we never married. What we did have was a qualified domestic relations order, which is the same document that people argue protects gays if they're, you know, oh, well, they say, well, they don't need to get married because they have a quadro to protect them. Well, the reality was when he got sick and died 3 years ago, I had no rights at all. I couldn't call the shots on what kind of treatment he got for his cancer. I couldn't even get his death certificate. I was called an unauthorized person. As far as his pension, real estate, we had $2.1 million in real estate. We didn't get it. It went to his family. Even his Social Security went to his former ex-wife. And so My point is, we might think, if a heterosexual couple not married with children in reality has no protection at all, but has great protection if they are married, then it's going to be so much more difficult for a homosexual couple, especially if they have children, to have any protection at all. And that is the reality. Without whatever anybody wants to say, and I, you know, people say like that one man, well, get a lawyer. I just didn't have, I didn't have enough money for a lawyer to enforce the qualified domestic relations order, and that's, you know, didn't have the $10,000 and $350 an hour. So it is absolutely imperative that gay couples are allowed to marry, especially if they have children.
Yeah.
And that's the point I wanted to make.
Thank you, Jennifer. You made it very eloquently, and you did a great job of backstopping my argument. Thank you. I appreciate it. Josh in Lock Springs, Wyoming. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, and it's Rock Springs.
Oh, Rock Springs.
R-O-C-K. Yeah, I'm a member of the Mormon Church, and I just like to say how much I disagree with their policy regarding homosexuals.
Yeah. Virtually every church has, I mean, the Mormons are a little more aggressive than most. They funded for, you know, much of this this effort in California to take down gay marriage. So it's, in the Mormon church, it's kind of gone beyond just disapproval all the way to homophobia. But, you know, with the exception of a few Christian denominations, the gays are largely on the outside. And I mean, that is changing. The Lutheran Church, the United Methodist Church are being a little more accepting. But you're good point, and thank you for calling and making it. It's very, very good. Dan in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've got a question and comment about the gay marriage thing. I guess, in a way, to me, I think about, why does the government have anything to do with marriage? You
know, well, because it's a legal contract. There's two different things. There's church marriage, which is a spiritual whatever you call it. And then there's this legal agreement that people make that has to be recognized by things like hospitals if somebody gets sick, or morgues and mortuaries if somebody dies, or the Social Security Administration if there's, you know, and inheritance courts. So that's, it is a, marriage is first and foremost, 99% of marriage is a legal contract, or the, you know, the legal consequences are 100% of the consequences of it are legal, at least in this world. Now, there are some people who get married in church because they believe that church, you know, is whatever. They will have an afterlife together if they get married. There's a whole variety of different belief systems around that. And I have no problem with a church saying that their particular church thinks that people should only be straight or gay or whatever, you know, and get married. The Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, I don't know their official position on this. I mean, there may be churches that only acknowledge gay marriage or something. But the point is that should, you know, those folks should just be able to go off and do whatever they want. But in terms of the secular legal institution, which is in our secular legal system of laws, in our government, that should be available to anybody who wants to get married.
I get that. I agree with that. It's just the word marriage, I think, is that it should have nothing to do. It should just be civil union. And what if two people that were just friends wanted to form a civil union? They're not even in love, maybe, but they want to take care of each other. I mean, when it gets marriage, it's like deciding if you're in love or something. How the hell could they even, you know, do they
some
get into
states,
something like that?
Some states have established civil union laws where you know, people who are who don't want to be married, who are not having a marriage relationship, you know, I think when we lived in Vermont and they were establishing this, one of the examples was, in fact, was actually given, you know, a couple came forward, was, you know, an elderly brother and sister. And they wanted to have the legal rights that would come along with that. They weren't living together in sin or anything like that. I mean, it was just they were in their 70s or 80s, but they wanted, you know, and maybe that, or maybe they were cousins or what, but whatever it was something like that. So, yeah, there are examples of that, and there are states who recognize that, and there are states
probably
that don't, and more should.
Is, you know,
but here's the problem with using the word union, civil unions, versus using the word marriage. There are over 10,000 laws at the state, federal, and local level that use the word marriage or married or spouse. And if you don't use that language, then people are not eligible to be covered, as the first caller in this segment talked about, under those laws, if you simply have some other designation. So that's my concern, Dan. Thanks a lot for the call. Tim in Cupertino, California. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I think you need to expand the frame. When you were talking with the guy saying if you think the Koch brothers factory gave your son autism because of the mercury poisoning.
Oh, this is from the last hour.
Right, that you can sue. I'm going to use a different one. If you give your child peanut butter that's contaminated and the factory knows about it and your child dies, you can sue. And if you have the money to sue, that's great, but your child is still dead.
Yes.
And I think the point of, you know, we need to pay to prevent the mercury from getting into the environment versus being able to, I mean, being able to sue after the fact is a good thing and I support it. But when you're talking to these folks, you need to, you know, your example, you need to expand. Your child still has autism or your child ate, you know, E. coli infected food and your child is still dead. Yeah, you can sue, but wouldn't it have been better to prevent it in the first place?
Yeah, excellent point. And then that's one of the big holes in libertarian philosophy and theology is that the libertarians only look backwards. In other words, all laws, or actually it's not even laws. It would be court precedent, period. And the only people following you, there still would be no law against putting, you know, aflatoxin in peanut butter or mercury in food. It would be the threat of a lawsuit. And the only people who could bring that lawsuits are people who have enough money to be able to do it. So, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. And well said. Richard in Eureka, California, listening to KGOE. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just calling you because when you talked earlier, you talked about the Zimmerman thing and stand your law grounds. And I never hear anybody saying anything about the killings, or however you want to put it, of police officers around in every state that applies to, not just the 26 states for ground stand your ground. And I think the Supreme Court has even upheld the right of police officers to kill in all they have to do really is claim their life was basically threatened. And they do get questioned about it. They do go under investigation, but the ones that investigate them are the ones that are in the police force, and they almost always are, I can't say always, but almost always are
exonerated.
Exonerated.
On the other hand, most police officers live in fear of the investigative unit within the police departments. I forget the name of it. That investigates those things, number one. And number two, you know, most officers in their entire careers, 20, 30, 40-year career, have never discharged their service revolver in, you know, or their weapon in the line of duty. And when they do, it's a big deal. And as the police officer who called in earlier, there's a series of escalations that you have to go through before you reach the point of being able to discharge your weapon. And you have to demonstrate that you have done that or something close to it. Yes, you're right. In many cases, you get people who are backed up or in some cases even by, you know, courts. And particularly, there's a racial element to this, particularly when, you know, it's a white cop and a black person who gets killed. There, you know, tragically in America, we still have those vestiges of racism alive and well. But that still, the point that police officer made when he called in, that police officers are more constrained by the law than George Zimmerman was, I think is a really important point, Richard. And thank you for calling, but I think it's a really important point. Carol in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to comment. I called the last couple of minutes of the Maggie Gallagher interview, mm-hmm. and I think what I heard her say more than once was that marriage doesn't matter for gay people. I want to give you a real-life experience of why it absolutely does matter for gay people.
Sure.
I have been in a 14-year relationship with my partner. We have one son who is mine biologically. Thankfully, there's one judge in South Carolina that would grant my partner legal adoption of my son. Mm. But we are both his legal parents. And as you can hear from my accent, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm British by birth. Mm. And so my son already has dual citizenship because I'm determined that he doesn't have to deal with the same kind of challenges that I have to deal with living here as a non-U.S. citizen.
Right.
I've been here 14 years, and I continue to fight with the immigration system to maintain legality.
Because you can't become a citizen because you're married, in other words.
Because I can't. My partner has no ability to sponsor me for a green card in the way that you, for instance, would be able to sponsor your British wife
right.
if you married somebody from
this
outside
is a
the
perfect
country.
Example of a law that has the word marriage in it or the word spouse
yes.
in it, and you are not able to access that as a gay couple, even
yes.
though you've been able to access some legal rights for your child. Excellent,
so
Carol.
We are going to end up with two children who are both parented by both parents, but she and I have no legal relationship to each other.
amazing. It's a travesty in this country. Carol, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service in a few minutes and more of your calls right after this. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Hey, Tom. Rick Santorum suspended his presidential campaign this afternoon.
Yes.
Both bowing, I think, to the inevitability of Mitt Romney's nomination, and also maintaining the viability of his own future within the conservative wing of his party.
And positioning himself, in, at least in his own mind, for 2016.
Exactly. He is only 53.
Yeah, and he didn't trash Mitt, but on the other hand, he didn't embrace him. He didn't say anything about him at all in his 20-minute going-away speech. And you would think that if he really wanted Romney to be president, that he would have done everything he could in that speech to say, okay, you people, you were with me, go out there and be with Mitt. But he didn't, which means that he doesn't want Romney to be president, because in 4 years, he wants Obama to be leaving office, not Romney to be running for re-election, so that he can run against him.
I think there's definitely truth to that. I think the other piece is, if I'm going to be generous, which I will be, I think there was a piece of him also for whom this speech was very personal. And he was close to tears as he gave this speech. And so I think some of that was genuine, as he was talking about going around the country and talking about how much a great part of this campaign was about hearing the stories of these American people. And I think as he was saying it, he believed it. I mean, he's a politician, so, you know, I think politicians are capable of believing what they're saying at the time. Because he also, at the same time, in the same speech, he also talked about how much his message of hope had been. And yet I remember during the campaign, the one candidate who was giving a gloom and doom message of, you know, impending destruction was Rick Santorum.
Interesting.
So, it was an interesting speech, but they have spoken, and I do expect him to endorse Romney fairly soon, because I think that he quite liked to have a major influence on his campaign, and at some point maybe a position within his cabinet if that happens.
Yeah, after all, Rick is out of a job right now. Although he made some pretty good money as a lobbyist or as a representative of some corporate interests, and
hopes to do so again. And
indeed,
of course, that's another piece of it. Meanwhile, Newt Gingrich, who over the weekend, as you remember, said quite loudly to anybody who'd watch him that Romney is basically tantamount to the nominee, and that even though that's the case, he's staying in, and he's staying in to influence the Republican Party platform, now says, I'm the true conservative in the race.
Aha, so Newt is trying to step into Rick's shoes, as it were.
Sort of, kind of thing.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yes.
In other words, I'm the anti-Romney. Ron Paul's outside the Republican mainstream. There's only one other Republican candidate in this other than Romney, and now it's Newt. And so Newt is saying, I'm the anti-Romney candidate.
Mitt Romney must feel like there are flies buzzing around his head.
Yes. Will someone rid me of this pesky priest?
Exactly. And there are people in the Republican Party who would do that, I mentioned.
Oh, God forbid. So what else is going on in the world, Victoria?
President Obama today traveled to Florida, a swing state. I'm sure it was a coincidence. Jay Carney was asked about that in the gaggle.
Yes.
To make the case for the Buffett rule. This, of course, the rule whereby those with incomes over $1 million would pay at least 30% in income tax.
Why not 35? 35 is the top income tax rate.
Well, I think they're trying not to be greedy.
Okay.
You know, they're trying not to make it completely unpalatable.
Okay.
not as I think they're trying to make they're making the point loudly to anybody who will listen. And the Obama campaign actually put a memo out about this today. 13.9% as Mitt Romney paid last year on his 20-something million dollars.
So a nice fallout from the Buffett rule debate is highlighting the fact that Mitt Romney made $23 million and only paid 13.9% income tax, whereas Warren Buffett's secretary is paying over 30% income tax.
Right, and this is going to be a meme. I mean, the statement they put out was Mitt Romney opposes the Buffett rule. He thinks millionaires and billionaires should keep paying lower tax rates than middle-class families. In fact, Romney himself isn't paying his fair share, blah, 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 blah.
Right, yeah.
So
politics.
People could say that there is certainly truth to that, and they've put out a 7-page fact sheet on the Buffett rule, stuffed full of facts and figures about how much incomes have changed for those in the very, very top bracket compared with the middle 60% and the middle this percent, and what a difference there is, and how much more CEOs are making, how they were making 30 times as much, now they're making 110 times as much as their workers, and how much the disparity has increased in recent years.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is
interesting? Well, also the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced today at an event an overhaul of the mortgage services industry.
Yes, they said they're going to put services back into the services industry.
That's the plan. They say it's an unaccountable and opaque industry, which, of course, as you know, recently agreed to a $26 billion settlement over things like robo-signing.
Is that settlement going to happen? I understand that there are some hiccups along the path to mangle the metaphor.
It's supposed to happen. We'll see. I don't know.
Okay.
But this is quite good. I mean, there are some very good things in this. If you get behind on your mortgage facing foreclosure, the services required to make a good faith effort to explain the process, provide counseling options. Services have to address errors within 30 days. They have to have staff dedicated to working with you. They also have to immediately credit payments received from borrowers. And they also have to, and this is going to shock you, Tom, mortgage statements have to be made clear for you so you can easily understand the terms of the mortgage.
Wow. No more 55-page legalese in all caps. It's got to be in plain English. Amazing.
No.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Up next, a rumble. Should corporations be able to buy other planets? I'm not kidding. We'll be back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing. Homesteading the final frontier. Rand Simberg is with us. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, an adjunct scholar at CEI.org. Rand, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Were you named after Ayn Rand?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
It's possible.
Pardon my personal question. It just
I never, you know.
I know Rand Paul was.
Yeah, I should have asked my mother sometime.
Yeah, there you go.
The books are on the shelf. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, executive summary here. This you are proposing that billionaires be able to buy a chunk of the moon or Mars or Venus or whatever right now, so that when they get there, or presumably the moon, they can get there. They can what? Build a summer home?
Well, they can sell the land to other people who want to purchase it.
So we could start a Ponzi scheme.
But it's not billionaires per se. It might be a billionaires, but it doesn't have to be billionaires. It could be people that it could be a corporation that simply raises the money to do it.
Well, I remember this thing years ago where you can, the National Star Registry. You too can have a star named after you or a loved one for only $25. Because all these stars out there are named, H2374-Z. And so they just Now it's named Louise Hartman. There's your star. But it actually was not official. It was not legal. It was just the star registry.
Yeah, the point of this is to make it official and legal.
Yeah.
I mean, people have been selling lunar real estate deeds for years.
Yeah, but they're not real.
But they're not real. There's no legal validity to them.
Right.
This proposal is to change that.
Isn't this kind of a variation on the way that the Europeans colonized the rest of the planet and said, this is ours, even when it wasn't theirs. Africa, North America, South America.
There were people living there at the time.
Well, if you're gonna sell off a planet in another solar system, how do you know there aren't people living there?
Well, I don't think we're worrying about other solar systems at this point. The point is that you can't do this. You cannot make the claim until you actually occupy it and establish transportation to and from.
Right. Okay.
You can't just say I own this, because that's already been determined in court that somebody tried to do that with the asteroid Eros a few years ago, and they said forget about it. I mean, it's not, you can't just say this is mine.
Okay. So up to this point, our argument has been kind of rational and lighthearted, I suppose. What happens though if to take the boogeyman du jour, the Iranian government takes a bunch of their oil revenue and they buy a quarter of the face of the moon?
They can't do it under this law.
Why?
Because the law requires that it be a non-governmental entity.
Okay, so let's say that the richest guy in Iran buys a quarter of the moon and decides to set up a military base there from which he can launch missiles at the United States.
That's physically impractical.
Yeah, it's impractical, but it sure would be. Can you imagine everybody looking at you're not probably old enough to remember Sputnik, but
I am.
Okay, I remember. I was little. I think I was 6 years old, 5 years old when Sputnik went over, and you could at night. I remember going out in my parents' backyard with my dad and mom and looking up and watching this thing just slowly move across the sky, this little light. And if you had a shortwave radio, you could hear it go ping, 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 as it passed. And Americans were terrified of this. I mean, terrified. My dad was talking about building a fallout shelter in Lansing, Michigan. And so can you imagine how much more frightening? I mean, the moon is so much bigger and more visible, even though it's not as close. The average person doesn't realize that.
It would be a stupid place to put weapons.
Shouldn't we say that? I guess the point of my point here is just like with the Antarctic and the Arctic. Shouldn't we say that there are not territorial waters to be had? This is international territory. If humans are going to colonize space, they're going to do it collectively rather than individually.
Well, it would be done collectively. It'd be a bunch of people gathering together.
No, I mean all of society.
Well, that's been the policy for the last 50 years. It's not happening.
But it is happening.
We are not colonizing space. We are not making any significant progress toward colonizing space. Because when you have a collective, then there's no incentive for anybody to do anything.
Well, what incentive is there for somebody to do anything anyway? I mean, if, say I've got legal title to 3 square miles of the moon. So what?
Well, it's in the context of a much larger claim, and it's the beginning of a sovereign nation that would, for instance...
So I can go create my own kingdom?
Yes.
So you're in favor of people having kingdoms?
Well, people can have their own. When a sovereign doesn't mean kingdom necessarily. I mean, the United States is a sovereign entity.
So I could create my own dictatorship?
If the people...
Is this the logical extension of libertarian thought that you should be able to create your own dictatorship if you've got enough money?
Well, nobody is forcing anybody to go live on the moon.
Right. So nobody's forcing you to live under this dictatorship unless you happen to be the child of a couple who decided to live on the moon and you were born making no decision. Then what?
But
and I live in your dictatorship and you say that everybody has to.
Why do you assume it will be a dictatorship?
Well, let's say that Rand Sinberg decides that he's going to buy a bunch of the moon and, he gets a corporation together, gets a bunch of billionaires to invest in it. He sets it up as a dictatorship and he says, everybody has to worship Rand. They've got to bow down to a picture of him and they got to paint green circles in the middle of their forehead. Now, if I choose to go there and Louise and I choose to go there, that's fine, but what if we choose to go there and we have children? Our children then are going to have to bow to pictures of you and paint green circles on their forehead?
Well, Rand Sinberg wouldn't do that. Rand Sinberg would set up something pretty much like the U.S., except it would be more getting back to the original Constitution.
Which means what? You could have slaves?
No. Which means, basically the founding principles other than the slaves, which was the fundamental flaw of the founding of the nation, which took us, several decades later, very bloodily, we fixed it.
Yeah, okay, so that's how you would set it up. But you want anybody who wants to set it up to be able to set it up any way they want, right?
I think that we need...
So how's Jim Jones going to set it up if he was still alive? He had a lot of followers and a lot of money, He actually was able to buy a chunk of Guyana.
Yes. And it didn't end well for him.
No, it didn't. So,
or the people that followed him, and that right. There are always going to be people like that. But we need a new place where we can do social experimentation and set up more laboratories to figure out what works and what doesn't.
So I get it. You're a libertarian, and libertarianism has never successfully been tried on any country anywhere in the 7,000-year history of civilization on planet Earth.
It was fairly other.
And
than
so you're suggesting that by establishing a colony on the moon, you could try libertarianism and demonstrate that it's viable because you can't prove it here on Earth.
Well, yeah, you can't prove it here on Earth because everything's taken. But we actually, there was something very close to a libertarian nation, and that was this country at the founding, other than the slavery problem.
I don't think so at all.
And
I would say that if you think that's true, you have not studied the history of the founders or the founding. You haven't read read Madison's notes on the Constitution.
I've read the Federalist Papers.
The Federalist Papers are nothing. That was a sales job for the Constitution, and it didn't talk about libertarianism. And for that matter, the Federalist Papers didn't talk about economic royalists.
It didn't use those words, but it was a very libertarian. The Constitution is a fairly libertarian document. And Hong Kong, prior to...
The people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, in order to establish the general welfare?
I don't think you understand libertarianism. Do you believe that libertarians are anarchists?
Anarchist is the wrong phrase, but my understanding of one of the principal tenets of libertarianism is that there isn't a society, there's a collection of individuals who are each seeking their own best interest, personal self.
But libertarians do believe that there's a legitimate role for government.
Yes, for defense
and
adjudication of disputes. Yeah, I got that. Defense and adjudication of disputes. But, we don't have time to make this into a debate about libertarianism. Rand Sinberg, people can read all about it at CEI.org. Thanks, Rand.
Thank you.
Good for you to drop by.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Should libertarians set up communities on the moon? Good question. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. In our first hour, we talked about how the soldiers in Iraq, and we had a caller who was a police officer. He said this is true of police officers in the United States as well, have to, before they can discharge a weapon, before they can use deadly force, have to walk through a series of progressively escalating steps. They must try to stop a suspect. They must show their weapon. They must shout at the person. They must try to physically restrain the person. And if all that doesn't work, then they may shoot the person. Whereas under the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws in Florida and 20 other states, pushed by Walmart and the NRA and brought into state legislatures by the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers funded ALEC, under these laws, George Zimmerman didn't have to do those things. So he has more of a Wild West right to kill than do our soldiers in Iraq or police officers here in the United States. That was in our first hour. In our second hour, Maggie Gallagher came on and talked about, we've covered a lot of other things throughout all these times, but she came on and argued that there should not be gay marriage, and I argued that the only people who sit around thinking about gay marriage are people who are gay, even if they're pretending that they're straight, and in fact, usually they are, if they're sitting around mumbling negatively about gay marriage. And Maggie had not acknowledged, well, I'll let her characterize herself. I don't want to get into that. Then Ram Sinberg, adjunct scholar of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, just basically said, libertarianism doesn't work on the United States. Let's try it on the moon. So, Ted, in Orlando, Florida, what do you think about it?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Good.
Long time, first time.
Thank you.
Hey, well, first, just briefly in response to this guy, Rand Sinberg, what antiquated kind of imperialist thinking would come up with a cockamamie plan like that to real estate on planets that no one owns is just it's just so painfully absurd that honestly I thought you were really generous in letting him rant on about it as long as he did.
Well, I kept trying to figure out why he wanted to do this. Why, you know, why would anybody want to, you know, have, I mean, who's going to want to go live on a colony on the moon? It's kind of nice here. I could see, you know, trying to buy an island in the Pacific, you know, hey, nice beach, good gentle breezes,
sure,
a little radiation from Japan, but otherwise everything's cool. But, you know, the moon, you know, you're bombarded by radiation from the sun. But then he finally came forward and said, well, this is, we're trying to try libertarianism someplace and we can't try it here on Earth because it's all used up. So how about the moon? And then the light bulb went off for me. So,
yeah, that was it. The second thing I wanted to tell you was that I'm a criminal defense attorney in Orlando. So unfortunately, this ends up being the epicenter for all of these big cases, it seems like, in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that hasn't been discussed, and, it's going to come out, is that, you know, this child was autopsied. And I can tell you, as someone who's used to be a prosecutor and who's been to autopsies, that probably within the first 5 minutes of that autopsy, the medical examiner had a pretty good idea of what had happened to that young man.
In other words, whether he was shot at close range or from a distance, whether he'd been involved in a struggle or not, those kinds of things.
Exactly. I mean, he may or may not have shown swelling on his knuckles if he had been in a fist fight, because it depends on how many blows he threw. But if he was shot at close range, and especially if what Zimmerman is saying is true, that Zimmerman was on his back and Trayvon was standing over him or was above him beating his head into the ground, that bullet is going to have a certain trajectory, which it wouldn't otherwise have if they were standing apart, if the two of them were vertical.
Right.
And there would be tattooing on his skin and on his shirt from the gunpowder, the burning gunpowder,
right,
from close range. And any forensic pathologist would have seen that within seconds of that body being brought to the medical examiner's office. When that evidence comes out, if the evidence comes out that it was the shooting was at close range, then Zimmerman's defense is going to be more robust. If it comes out that bullet went straight through him at a horizontal trajectory and that he has no powder burns, then Zimmerman is going to have a very difficult time explaining why he shot that young man.
Why, Ted, might this information not be available?
Because the state attorney's office is still involved in an ongoing investigation. When the investigation is ongoing, the information is non-public. As soon as they make a charging decision, then the information becomes public.
I agree with
the earlier caller that the fact that the prosecutor's chosen not to take it to the grand jury means that she's determined to, in all likelihood, she's going to charge him with something. It's not going to be first-degree murder. I've talked with some of my friends, and I think it's very likely that it'll be second-degree murder.
Aggravated manslaughter?
Or possibly manslaughter. But second-degree murder is a kind of a homicide where someone does something that's very dangerous and reckless that's almost certainly going to result in the death of another human being, but they don't have to prove that they had premeditation.
Right.
And that's probably pretty good on the facts as we know them so far.
Right, and second-degree murder is also life sentence, not death penalty.
Right, exactly. It would be a life sentence. And in this case, even if it was premeditated, probably wouldn't be a death penalty case anyway, because he doesn't have any prior history. It wasn't done in a heinous, atrocious, and cruel manner. So it probably wouldn't be a death penalty case. Even if he walked up to him and killed him in cold blood, it's unlikely that it would be a death penalty case anyway.
Right. Interesting. As a Florida criminal defense attorney and former Florida prosecutor, when do you expect this stuff is going to come out? Particularly given how politicized this is. I mean, the police chief and mayor are just freaked out. They got Nazis, right? Literally guys who call themselves Nazis walking around town with guns strapped to their hips.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that it hasn't happened already. Really, I don't think there's that much evidence for them to review. I doubt very seriously that the state attorney's office did much of an independent investigation. I mean, in other words,
they've got some tapes, they've got some witnesses, and they've got the body.
And that's it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I think the police officer spoke to the eyewitnesses, and that testimony's already been memorialized. So,
right.
I don't think that there's that much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I'm sorry we're out of time. 27 minutes past the hour. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very uxori volentously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. Judge Elizabeth Magner. Magner, a federal bankruptcy judge in Louisiana, said that Wells Fargo's behavior during 5 years of litigation with a single homeowner was, quote, highly reprehensible, end quote, and ordered the giant bank to pay the homeowner a staggering $3.1 million in damages. This is the biggest fine yet for mortgage servicing misconduct. Magner has a history of criticizing the home loan practices of big banks and defending the homeowner. It's about time we punish the big banks that destroyed our economy with more than just a slap on the wrist. Good on you, Judge Magner. The bad, Jacqueline Cassell. Cassell, the superintendent of the Pontiac Academy for Excellence Middle School in Pontiac, Michigan, fired one of her teachers last week for organizing a fundraiser for Trayvon Martin's family. Brooke Harris, the teacher, knew that many of her students were politically engaged and wanted to help Martin's parents. So she helped them plan a fundraiser where each student would donate a dollar to wear a hoodie for a day. Apparently, Superintendent Cassell is against such activism and fired Harris, saying she's not being paid to be an activist, but being paid to teach. I guess telling children that political activism is wrong was an awful lesson to teach. I get it. That's amazing. And the very, very ugly, Herman Cain. In an interview today on Fox so-called news, Cain suggested that Mitt Romney is losing the support of women because women aren't as familiar with policy as men are. Referring to President Obama's policies, he said, I think many men are much more familiar with the failed policies than a lot of other people, as well as the general public. Basically, Cain is saying that women are stupider than men and don't have the ability to understand politics. Sorry, Herman. Calling women stupid is not going to help Republicans gain ground and is very, very ugly. That's very, very ugly. That's amazingly ugly. Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, you had some character on there about wanting to buy the moon.
Hey, it's Competitive Enterprise Institute. This is a big think tank here in town.
Well, to be quite honest with you, it went from greed to total arrogance, and I don't know what other kind of word I can think of, narcissism. Anyway, there is some logic, though, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I remember reading back in 2003 on the Internet, by the year 2018, NASA would be turning over its whole entire thing to the private corporations so they can go out and explore and mine all the different planets of the universe.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a tragedy. Although, keep in mind, the original rationale for NASA, while it was sold to the American people as, isn't it cool, we can put a man on the moon and all this kind of stuff, the original rationale was military. Let's militarize space. Let's beat the Russians to it, you know, or beat the Soviets to it. So, you know, it's an oddball thing. But, you know, what I found most fascinating was libertarians think that their chances here on Earth are zero. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a comment about the libertarians on the moon. I say let them have it if they promise to take Ron Johnson and Rand Paul with them and promise never to come back.
Yeah. The problem is they've got to get the money. Of course, they got a lot of money. They got the Koch brothers are libertarians. So,
yeah, right.
Good,
can go there.
Good point. Thank you very much for the call. Hans or Hans in Coburn, Colorado. How do you say it? Hans?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering, George Zimmerman is in hiding, and his father will only appear in silhouette because they're afraid. So to me, that means that they're very dangerous, and they could shoot anybody who approaches their house, and it seems they should be taken into productive custody for their safety and the public safety.
Well, I suspect that if the prosecutors in Florida are developing a case for, as the defense attorney you called earlier suggested, which makes perfect sense to me, second-degree murder, that you know, they're going to be developing this. The thing that I find interesting, the interesting development in this, has just been reported in the last hour or so, is that George Zimmerman's attorneys say that they can no longer find the guy. They can't communicate with him. I wonder if he's on the lam. You know, if he's,
well,
if he's on the run.
He's running and he's afraid of everyone. He's very dangerous right now, and it seems like it's a public safety matter.
Right, and if he's got a gun, that's...
who knows how many guns he has.
Very, very dangerous. Hans, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Chris in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, you know, sending the Koch brothers to the moon, as far as I'm concerned, is just a fabulous idea, but...
I wouldn't oppose it. yeah, if it was done humanely.
I'm all for it. I wanted to just point out that a lot of folks argue they try to argue the gay marriage thing rationally using secular points of view, which, you know, generally speaking, I'm pretty secular, but I'm also a Unitarian Universalist, and as you might know, we embrace secular humanism as well as everything else. So
sure.
And
embrace gay marriage.
Yes, wholeheartedly. And my point is, nobody that I know of has argued the point that preventing gay marriage federally is actually respecting an establishment, a Christian establishment of religion, and prohibiting me from expressing a portion of mine.
Oh, that's interesting. And at the founding of this country, you know, the Unitarians and the Universalists, or at least the Unitarians, I don't know if the Universalists were around at that time, but
they were, okay.
But the Unitarians specifically, I mean, when I read Jefferson's diaries, he must have mentioned the Unitarians and the Quakers. Well, I think maybe it was just the Unitarians. Many times, they were a persecuted minority in this country.
Yeah. And then we had a couple of Unitarian presidents down the line.
Who was that?
But we had. Let's see now. Now you've made me blank.
I scared it out of you. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I didn't know we had a Unitarian president.
But you can actually, if you want to look it up on the net, you can find them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I think your point is well made, Chris, that if somebody wants to argue a religious argument that, you know, we're stepping on their religion by allowing gay marriage, that they're stepping on your religion, universalist Unitarian. It's an excellent point. Chris, thank you for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Dan in Detroit. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Well, I just got to get on here. I'm an old-timer that I went on the job in Detroit in 49.
On the job as a police officer?
Right.
Okay.
And there was no such thing as a gun.
Really?
Detroit had less than 10 murders a year, and there were 2 million people.
And you, as a police officer, you did not have a gun?
Oh, we had guns, yes.
Oh, you did.
Nobody used them. That's all. It was nothing.
Yeah, and the citizenry was not armed.
Gun after, that's about the only reason you'd fire anyhow.
Right. And nobody pointed.
Knives and razors, that were the danger part.
Yeah.
It was the television that brought on this love for guns.
It certainly reinvented the Old West. I mean, the Old West, from what I've read, the frequency with which you would have gunfights in towns was so low that entire states never had it happen. And, I mean, there may have been a couple of towns that were kind of notorious for a couple of bad gunfights. But, you know, outside of outlaws who would rob banks, that was pretty much it. It was, you know, it's this whole mythos has been created, was created during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s with these TV westerns that portrayed a reality that never existed in the United States.
There was even a difference in the officers that were coming on the job in 1950. They watched too many cop television stations.
Uh-huh. Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for sharing your wisdom and experience with us. I appreciate it. Dino in Paterson, New Jersey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Dino, what's up?
How you doing? All right, Tom?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better.
All right, great. Good, good, good. Now, first of all, I'm going to say I'm a right-wing Republican. I'm not going to beat around the bush here.
Okay.
But as far as gay marriage, I'm against it, but I totally agree with you that I believe, like you, it's biological. I have nothing against gay people. And I would
then
say
why shouldn't they be allowed to get married?
Well, that's what I would. This is how I see it. Initially, I got two daughters, and you know I got enough problems to raise my daughters. Rather than have, you know, the gay people, 90% of gay people are all right. Got no problem. The ones who are down in you know Lower Manhattan during the Halloween you know parade, doing you know hanging with their junk out, doing with a G-string. That's what I'm against.
And, but all you have to do is drive through any big city, and you'll see the same thing in a straight version. You never heard of a strip club?
Why do we have to show it in another version?
And down in Florida, I mean, spring break, girls gone wild.
Let me get back to my point. Listen, I would have no
straight people do that a lot more than gay people.
True, true. But let me get back to my point. Well, I had no problem. I think Gary Newsom did the big mistake in San Francisco going for gay marriage. What they should have done, because a lot of gay people say the same thing, is that he ruined it for them. What they should have done maybe is make civil unions just as strong as marriage. So that's why
the way you do that is you call it marriage because there's already tens of thousands of laws on the books, or over 10,000 laws on the books that use the words marriage or spouse. And if you, and this was the experience of Vermont. I lived in Vermont when they passed the civil unions law. It was the first in the country. Howard Dean was the governor at the time, and he signed it. He was just a few blocks from my house. And the problem was that all of a sudden there was all these marriage laws, especially federal laws, that were not recognized because the state was not using the word marriage. So
that's what we should correct.
You can do that, and that's the clumsy roundabout about the back way to do it. Why not just say marriage and religious marriage, or you know, civil marriage and religious marriage? I mean, that might be a way to do it. Dino, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think at the end of the day, the word marriage, I mean, it's we had this conversation back in the 1950s about whether people of different races should get married.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jay in Chicago, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? And I hope you don't get into it here. I love your show, and I think you're right on target most of the time. But, right? Well, I have to tell you, you know, I'm married to a black woman. I heard that last comment you made. I'm not going to take it out of context, but it brings up a subject I dealt with, which is that interracial marriage is not something that should be on the same platform as homosexuality. And I've heard it mentioned before when people are trying to accept things, you know, like, well, you know, you guys aren't gay. You're a man and a woman. So I just wanted to point that out to you. I think this is more about power. Who has the power? Because when I look at it, the marriage is a sacrament. That's the issue. So, you know, I'm a believer. So if I'm a believer, I'm sticking to my guns, you know, and people, you know what?
Okay, so what you're saying two things here, if I may, Jay. You're saying two things. One is that for you, marriage has a religious component to it. I understand that. I honor that. I leave that to you. I don't think, however, you or your religion should be making our laws. They should be secular. The second point is that you were born white and your wife was born black, right?
Yes.
How is that different from two men or two women who were born gay?
Well, if it's biological, there's another debate. So I mean,
oh, it's not a debate.
But you're assuming.
Let me ask you, Jay. How old were you when you first noticed that there was something different about girls that was really interesting?
Oh, geez. Probably junior high, I would think. Maybe sixth grade.
So 12 thereabouts. For me, it was probably around 8 or 9. I'm guessing. I didn't mark it down in a calendar, but you know, it was before puberty. It was long before puberty. It wasn't associated with the hormones kicking in, or maybe it was in early. And I think, you know, most boys and girls, most men and women will tell you that somewhere between the age of 5 and 12, they started noticing that they had an attraction either to the same sex or the other sex. And
well, Tom, I'm not even disputing the what I'm disputing.
So doesn't that demonstrate that it's biological?
that we don't know. Each case is different. I gave you mine, you gave me yours. I mean, I don't think that's the right argument. I think
when you ask that question right across the board, everybody answers it the same way. Nobody decided at the age of 20, I think I'll be gay.
So nothing's learned. People don't shift gears.
That's correct.
Republicans don't become Democrats.
That's
what you're saying. I mean,
with regard to sexual preference, with regard to sexual preference with men, the science is really, really solid. Men, right across the board, will tell you that gay men will tell you they started noticing other boys as being really interested in girls as being kind of irrelevant sometime in that 5 to 12 year old range. Among women, it's a little more ambiguous, but not anywhere near as ambiguous as you would think. So,
no, but I mean, what does that have to do with the law? In other words, since we have laws on the books in our
so
the,
if
so
you have if the law used to be that your marriage to your Caucasian, your wife is African American, if the law used to be that you were it couldn't legally, you know, it was called miscegenation, it was illegal. If and I always mangle the word, my apologies. If the law used to be that was illegal and now it's legal because the rationale is, hey, you were born that way. You didn't have any control over that. We're not going to discriminate on people, you know, against people based on how they were born. Then why would you discriminate against gay people based on how they were born?
So then it comes up. So the man and woman premise, the basis of the sacrament, we're throwing a lot of things out the window.
Right. As soon as you get to sacrament. You're gonna, you know, if you're a Unitarian Universalist, two men can have a sacrament, you know, a marriage sacrament. Two women can have a marriage sacrament. It's part of their religion.
Here's the problem. What's the norm in this country? And it's not the majority, obviously. It should be, and it should.
Okay, then if we're gonna
look at the forefathers and their intent, we know all this has been bastardized, demonized. It's been shifted.
Jay, if we're gonna go with the norms in society. Then the laws, then we should have kept the miscegenation laws because that was the norm in American society for over 200 years, for arguably over 400 years.
We're talking about men and women, and we're talking, you know, so anything goes. I mean, we don't draw the line anywhere. I'm saying we draw the line between a man and a woman as the foundation
I don't
of
know.
Being Christian, the forefathers, and their intent being along those lines. By, you know, there are many writings that support that. So, all right, well, I'll equate it to this. Someone sees a prayer on the school window, and someone tells them, you know what, you can have them take that down. Now, they really don't want anything in its place, but because they have a right to remove it, they'll be damned, and they're going to go forth and get it removed. So it's this nothingness. It's about nothingness. So what is the battle really over? It's over power, in my estimation. It's not equality.
So you're concerned the gays are trying to have power over you?
In general, this is a power play. That's also.
Well, I don't, you know, Jay, I don't disagree. I think gays would like to have the. Hang on just a second, Jay. I think that gays would like to have the power to be able to visit their spouse when their spouse is ill. They would like to have the power of inheritance. You're absolutely right. Economics and law confer power. It is a power issue. And you want to deny that power to them. And I'm baffled as to why. Especially when you've seen how destructive discrimination can be.
Because I look at my hinge on my faith, and I make a determination there. And I look at it as part and parcel of the whole destruction of, I mean, it's happening before our eyes as the world coalesces into a new world order. This is
so you're seeing people being gay as the end of the world stuff.
You know, I mean, it's easy to isolate the statement and make.
I didn't mean that to ridicule you. I meant that honestly.
I think it's part and parcel of a bigger. I mean, I think there are a lot of facets.
You see it as a moral failing.
I do.
See, I don't. I see it as a way a person is born, and that's where we're going to have to differ. And but Jay, I don't know anybody who noticed at the age of 7 that they were attracted to lampposts. You know, anyhow. Enough is enough. How many more people have to die before we do something about the castle doctrine, the so-called stand your ground, shoot first laws? I'll confront Alan Corwin, pro-gun advocate and author of After You Shoot. This should be entertaining. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, where we occupy the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.